Hi, this is Bridget with the Urban Farm Project, and my guest today is John Toth, but he is running late. So we are going to wait until he calls in so that he can be connected on the show. We were going to be talking with him about some of his entrepreneurial business skills, and he's been creating some Buy Local groups and businesses and helping to create jobs here in the Reno, Nevada area. John also is involved with permaculture, and he's also involved Let's Be Growing here in the Reno area, and he was also an environmental scientist in Hawaii. So when he calls in, we'll have him on the show. And so I'm looking through some of the permaculture websites online, and it says the ethical foundation of permaculture guides the use of these designs and tools, ensuring that they are used in appropriate ways. So that's kind of an interesting philosophy, permaculture ethics. So it looks like involved in permaculture and the ethics, there are three ethics: care of the earth, care for people, and fair share. They form the foundation of permaculture design and are also found in most traditional societies. Ethics are cultural, evolved mechanics that regulate self-interest, giving us a better understanding of good and bad outcomes. The greater the power of humans, the more critical ethics become for a long-term cultural and biological survival. Permaculture ethics are distilled from research into community ethics, learning from cultures that have existed in relative balance with the environment for much longer than more recent civilizations. This does not mean that we should not ignore the great teachings of modern times, but in the transition of a sustainable future, we need to consider values, concepts outside the current and social norm. That's pretty good, ethical. Ethical principles to follow, or the ethics. We're going to look at principles now. So design principles is what it's talking about here. It says the 12 permaculture design principles are thinking tools that when we use together allow us to creatively design our environment and our behavior in a world of less energy and resources. That's pretty good principles. And the principles, says these principles are seen as universal, although the methods used to express them will vary greatly according to the place and situation. They are applicable to our personal and economic and social political reorganization and illustrated in the permaculture flower. So, looks like in the permaculture flower, ooh, this is pretty cool. It actually goes around, and so let's see if we can. It says, so principle one is observe and interact. Principle number two, catch and store energy. Principle number three is obtain a yield. Principle number four, apply self-regulation and accept feedback. That's pretty cool. And some of these, like, you can go into further. And I'm on permacultureprinciples.com. So, let's see. Principle five, use and value renewable resources and services. Ooh, principle number six is produce no waste. Principle number seven, design from patterns to details. Principle number eight, integrate rather than segregate. Number nine, use small and slow solutions. Number 10, use and value diversity. And number 11, use edges and value the marginal. Wow, that's some pretty cool stuff. pretty cool stuff. Okay, so let's go into more detail here. So this is principle number one, observe. Let's find it. Observe and interact. All right, so to observe and interact. Well, let's see. It doesn't really say a lot about observing and interacting, but from biodynamics, we like to practice this, and we practice it in a phenomenology way that's based kind of more on Goethe's work. And we learn to observe more from the observer and to notice ourselves observing. We also try to bridge it with some art or some kind of drawing to help with that side of the brain, and also how we interact, you know, within these systems. So as far as observation, I think it is one of the most important parts of farming or growing food or producing a garden. It's you have to notice, like, you know, if you have good bugs and bad bugs. So observation is probably a pretty good thing. And also the kind of observation, I think, that comes from, I know for me, you know, how I like to deal with gardening and observation is, like, I have a left brain type that deals with the past and the future and a lot of details. And then I have a right brain type of how I observe. And that's more from a perspective of just observation without having any, like, attachment. And I think, like, people like Eckhart Tolle have really mastered the right brain type observation. But anyway, so observation is very important. Do it from both parts of your brain and both parts of who you are. So let's see, catch and store energy. This is something, like, you know, that I'm actually been thinking a lot about. And in the area that I'm in Reno, Nevada, it's really important to actually think about water harvesting and using that kind of stored energy as water. And able to feed your garden beds for longer than you have rain. So I think it's a pretty good thing to do. And solar power would also fall into that catching energy type thing and storing energy. How to store it once you've gotten it. That's a whole other method. Let's see. So let's go ahead and see if we can do something else here and look at a word that I saw recently that was being used John in one of his emails talked about peri-urban, and I was not really sure what peri-urban was exactly. So I wanted to look that up. So we might as well do that now. Give you a full, let's see. I'm still looking for the peri-urban definition. All right, so here we go. It's immediately adjoining an urban area, the suburbs and countryside. So I guess it would be like kind of the borders immediately adjoining. So I guess there's no separation. So you just go from one, the suburbs, to the countryside. That's pretty cool. So I imagine that peri-urban could be really important, especially in large cities where they're going to have to grow food outside of the city in order to support the city. They would be growing it in a peri-urban, peri-urban place. All right, so anyway, I was hoping to talk to John about hydroponics and some other scenarios today.
John is with us. John.
Oh, yes. Hi, John.
Hi, Bridget.
Hey, sorry. Sorry we didn't get a hold of you at the very beginning.
Okay, I'm glad to be talking with you.
Yeah, so anyway, I was talking to some of my listeners, trying to kind of ad-lib a little bit about you, and I just was talking about the peri-urban. I wasn't really sure what the peri-urban was, so I was looking up the definition.
Okay.
So, but anyway, so do you want to give us a little bit of background about who you are?
Oh, sure. Thank you. I am John Toth here in Reno, Nevada, and I've been an advocate of local agriculture and innovations incorporating kind of ancient techniques of agriculture as well. Back in the 70s, I worked in Hawaii and was involved with the early stages of the development of the aquaculture industry there, and had the opportunity to work as an environmental scientist there. And since then, I've kept my interest in hydroponics, aquaponics, have developed an interest in permaculture, which is contraction for permanent agriculture. I'm working on my permaculture design certificate this year. And just, I believe in us producing more of our own food and doing that in an urban environment or in that urban agriculture interface, which is what I refer to as and many of us are calling the peri-urban area, which was what you were looking up when we first started. I had some early incidents impact my outlook on life. I grew up next to a river that caught fire in 1969 and a lake, a great lake that was thought to be dying, and the last part of my commute to high school overlooked the valley where the steel mills were spewing stuff into the air and into the water. And ever since then, I've really thought that we could do a whole lot better. And so I think that ought to serve as a good introduction, I hope.
That sounds like a great introduction. So what kind of impacts did you have did you say that there was a river that caught fire by where you lived?
Right, and some of the listeners might know that was in Cleveland, Ohio. The Cuyahoga River caught fire in 1969 because of all the pollution and the flammables that seemed to have pooled on top of the water. And a boat was burned, a bridge was burned, a warehouse was singed. And so it was a very unique incident given that it was a river that caught fire. Usually we use water to put fires out, but in this instance, the river actually caught fire.
Wow, that's incredible. Whoa. That's so how did that, like, impact you? I mean, how old were you when that happened?
That was 1969, and I was still 17 at the time that occurred. And I, as I mentioned, the last part of my commute for 4 years of high school via public transportation was along the rim of the valley where I would see the steel mills spewing the pollution into the air and into the water, and the water was the Cuyahoga River, and the Cuyahoga River emptied into Lake Erie, and, you know, Lake Erie had its challenges at that time. And started off as a Boy Scout with the conservation badges and had some early experiences with science fair projects. I observed a pair of red-tailed hawks for about 4 years in high school, too, and during that whole four-year period, they never successfully fledged a young fledgling, and I'd go up into the nest after they had left, and I'd find these broken, thin eggshells, and right about that time, the news about DDT came out, and its effect on the birds of prey concentrating DDT in their bodies and how it affected their ability to reproduce. And so, yeah, I got kind of hammered with some early incidents that really fueled my interest in nature and helping preserve the planet. I wouldn't have necessarily called it that at that time, but that's kind of how it turned out.
Wow, that's pretty intense for a teenager. I mean, really, to have to deal with a lot of that stuff, you know.
Yeah, and I also worked at a large market, the West Side Market in Cleveland, which actually is right next to the River Valley and only about six blocks from where I went to high school, and that also I could see the benefits of, and I grew up with that market as well, because we actually at one time lived close to it and we could walk to it. So that's where we went and did our shopping, as we did our most of our shopping at the West Side Market, and I ended up working there in high school. And the local farmers would come in with their produce, and they'd have set up the stands on the outside perimeter of the market, and then the indoor, which is about 25,000 square feet, if I remember right, that was all set up for the dairy and the meat products. And I worked in one of the stands there on Saturdays. So that was also kind of one of the early experiences that had me thinking, you know, we can if we have the space and have the capacity, we can grow food. All the homes that I lived in had a vegetable garden, flower garden, and many of them had fruit trees. And if they weren't there when I moved in, they were there when I left. So that's part of what I've been up to.
I think you've had amazing life so far. So I wanted to talk to you more about, like, when you were saying that you were a environmental scientist in Hawaii, was there a specific type of science that you were studying there, or was it just a general?
It was. I did the chemistry. I did the chemistry for a number of projects, including the first environmental impact survey of Pearl Harbor. And I guess I would say my academic interest was in organic chemistry, but my activities, a lot of it, were involved with water chemistry and analytical chemistry to, you know, do the environmental work.
Wow. So was there anything, like, that you could talk about the some of the things that you guys came up with from the environmental impact of Pearl Harbor? Because, I mean, this would have been done a long time after Pearl Harbor, right?
Right, it was in that 1975-77, so with that I kind of gave away my age, I guess. 1975-77 was the period, and the Navy was looking for a baseline study of mainly the impact of the ship traffic going into and out of the harbor area, because it's a pretty shallow estuary, and it's had a long history of ships coming in and out, and then of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor and the consequences of that. And what we discovered was there was just a vast, very fertile environment. It was way different than the open ocean environment, of course, because not only was there the chronic basic exposure to everything from anti-fouling paints to keep marine critters off the hulls of the ships, to the leakage of oil, to the runoff from the valleys and that basically flow into Pearl Harbor. And there was a power plant at one time in operation there, too. I'm not sure if it still is or not, but it was at that time. So we found the typical types of things. We found the area around the power plant to be particularly hot with metals concentrated in tissues, the things that we found in the marine critters were really not that different than the open ocean environment. It was just a different type of environment because of the nutrients, the fertility, the what we would call pollutants, you know, that were there. There are lots of sponges and fish and prawns and shrimps, and it was pretty prolific.
Yeah, it sounds like it was
a very rich environment.
Yeah, so with your experience in Hawaii, was there anything that when you left there, you know, kind of made more of a, I don't know, sounds like it could have been quite a defining moment in your life when you were there and then you left after your studies.
Well, I left a somewhat. I felt I was. I used the term complete. It was like my time there was finished. And part of the reason why I left is I was actually being interviewed for a position in, of all places, Pueblo, Colorado, where the utility was interested at that time in using the waste heat from the power plant to do, of all things, an aquaculture system, with eventually expanding it into doing hydroponics. And I was one of the candidates that they were interviewing, so I took that opportunity to relocate to Colorado, and that position, unfortunately, that project didn't pan out. But about the only disappointment that I had when I left Hawaii was we had demonstrated that we could grow algae for food and fuel. We had a fairly infant industry with aquaculture going. It just seemed like we were ahead of the time. Some associates of mine and I put together a plan for an aquaculture farm on the Big Island, and when we finished our little feasibility study, we did a half-acre freshwater prawn pond, and we started going around to the restaurants thinking that the chefs would be interested in fresh product. We had our expenses that we had to cover in order to keep in business, and the market wasn't ready for it. They preferred the frozen, cheaper marine, the natural fishery caught prawns over what we could offer. So we ultimately abandoned that the plans for the aquaculture farm. My friends continued, but they shifted away from doing freshwater prawns to actually shipping Chinese catfish to the fish market in Honolulu, and they had a nice little business. They were shipping about 250 pounds a week over to the weekly fish market in Honolulu. But you know, 250 pounds of fish making about $1 a pound really wasn't much of a business.
Yeah, I understand that being in farming in general is you know, you're always kind of barely holding on.
Right.
You're like, okay, I think I might get through this week. So one of the other things, like, I met you in Reno, so I'm just going to tell people that. And through Dave Asher, who's going to be on the 12th, his Live Local here in Reno, or Buy Local and Live Local. Anyway, so I was really interested in having you on the show. And you've had just, like, an amazing life. This is why I like to have certain people on the show, because I get to talk to them about their just amazing lives. So I wanted to just, since we're still on the topic of farming, do you want to give us, like, a brief rundown, and if you have any experience in your history with hydroponics and your take on it, and to just kind of inform through experience the listeners?
Right. Thanks. My interest in hydroponics, I was actually first introduced to it when I was in Hawaii, and there are a number of applications of hydroponics. And hydroponics goes back to ancient Babylon. The Hanging Gardens in Babylon were actually hydroponic. There's a whole sequence of the evolution of hydroponics. The earliest recordings of hydroponics were actually back before the Common Era. There are actually documents that were discovered that report growing plants and food in water without soil back in the 370 BCE era in Greece. And so there's been interest in growing food, growing plants without soil for millennia. And before World War II, on Wake Island, there was actually a commercial hydroponics farm that was put there for the Pan America Clipper, the seaplanes that would take off from San Francisco and fly to Asia would stop at Wake Island for food and fuel and provisions. And because it was so expensive to try to ship fresh produce from the United States or from Asia. They actually had a hydroponics facility there that would provide fresh produce for the crews and the passengers and the pilots and the maintenance folks. So there's hydroponics. If you Google it, you can find a great history of hydroponics. And during World War II, there were, in some of the campaigns in the Pacific, the U.S. military, actually, once an island was taken over, I believe they had a hydroponics facility on Iwo Jima after the battles there and on some of the other islands. So there has even, the government has had an interest in hydroponics for a long time. And so I was introduced to it. There's, of course, a whole group of people who like to grow the medicinal herb, shall we say, with it. But my interest has been in mainly tomatoes, salad greens, microgreens, and basil. I've grown some of that, quite a bit of that. A wide variety of lettuce greens in particular do well with hydroponics. And we had an effort with the group at the University of Nevada, Reno, which was the last commercial activity that I was involved with. It was a joint venture between the university and a group called Nevada Naturals. And unfortunately, that didn't work out real well. And the hoop houses have been vacant for a couple of years now. The university recently made an announcement that there's a collaboration coalition of farmers here in northern Nevada that are forming a committee, and there's some activity with possibly putting in some additional hoop houses and a year-round greenhouse to provide more locally grown food in our community. So it's had some kind of rough steps, but looks like it might be back on track. And Rick Latin of Latin Farms is involved, and Marco Farrell of Hungry Mother Organics, two of our local farmers are involved with that activity with the university. And so I believe hydroponics and the incorporation of fish, which then shifts into, by definition, aquaponics, which is a form of hydroponics. Hydroponics simply defined as just growing without soil, and aquaponics is fish culture with vegiculture. And you know, we've seen demonstrations of this again for millennia, the polyculture systems around the world, with in Mexico and in particularly in Asia, where there are lettuce rafts, basically produce floating on top of fish ponds. You know, that's the very rudimentary version of it. But there's quite a bit of interest in the United States at this time and around the world in aquaponics and growing fish and growing vegetables together. The fish basically provide the nitrogen for the plants. The plants basically clean up the fish water, the fish water, and so there's a natural biology, could be a closed loop system, even if you end up growing the food on location, which feeds the fish. The fish then do their thing in the water. The water then goes through the biofiltering process with the plants. The plants get their nutrients and they grow and they clean up the water. And so you can actually create a closed loop system with some careful considerations. You can grow fly larvae and if you compost with vermiculture, you could have worms to feed the fish. So it's a pretty fun system to consider.
I think it's a it's kind of interesting because I've seen videos and stuff, and I've been on some permaculture retreats but most of what I've seen are usually ponds with fish in them, you know, where they irrigate the crops with, you know, like the water when it starts to rain, and they can let some of the water out, and then they, you know, eat some of the fish. And then I've seen, you know, like backyard aquaponics thing, I guess, just for fish. So I haven't really seen anything like you were mentioning with, like, you know, floating salad bars. on top of the ponds, and that is just amazing. That would just super fun thing.
The polyculture systems that are mostly in Asia, where they haven't had such controls put in place yet, like the Food and Drug Administration and Environmental Protection Agency and those agencies, which really, I want to be clear that they definitely provide a service and a function for us, but they're a little looser with their environmental regulations for whatever reason. That I don't think it's necessary to really dwell on that much, but there are lots of places where they have the farm animals. They scoop the farm animal manure, dump it into the pond. The pond feeds the fish, and then they have these floating rafts that they grow their greens on, and they just pull them over and do the harvest and such. So that's kind of the basic model, but there are commercial aquaponics efforts coming online. The largest one is actually in Saudi Arabia, which should be up at this time. There's 2 acres of greenhouses that were being designed, planned, and constructed. The 1 acre of greenhouses was for the fish operation. The other acre of greenhouses is for the produce, mostly tomatoes, lettuce, whatever it is that they particularly want to grow over there for their market. And they're looking, just to give an idea of what the production is, 2 acres, that particular design, they're looking at a million pounds of food per year coming out of that operation.
Are you serious?
Yes. And we have some support of that. There's a group in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that was started by a pro basketball player, Will Allen, and it's called Growing Power. And they have several acres in urban Milwaukee, downtown Milwaukee, and they're saying that their 2 to 3 acres produce on the order of a million pounds of food a year, too. So we can do high-density, good-tasting, fresh produce in relatively small spaces. And so the individual family could get in and produce, whether it's just hydroponics or fish. The fish add a level of complexity to it because you have to monitor the chemistry, and it's just another batch of living things that you have to take care of in a farming environment. But we can grow quite a bit of food in relatively small spaces, and I encourage anybody who has an interest to get started. And even if it saves a couple of trips to the grocery store a month, it's a good thing to do, and it's fun. It's when we had the greenhouses going over at UNR, when it was my time to show up, I'd show up and I'd pick a handful of lettuce greens and I'd eat it like an ice cream cone. And I like that. I also have, it's not in production right now, but I have come up with a pretty simple vertical growing system on a cart where I have grow lights over a hydroponic system. And I was getting 12 to 18 pounds of greens a month. I wasn't growing any tomatoes or any other. It was basically the basil and lettuce greens that I was growing, and I was getting 12 to 18 pounds a month for about $13, including the cost of the lighting of the grow lights. I had it up against the south-facing window, so during the time when we had natural light, the plants were getting the light through the window, and then I'd have the lights on before and after for a typical 12 hours, 12 hours of light per day on and 12 off. And I was having trouble keeping up with the harvesting. I was giving it away to friends and neighbors, and of course using getting a fresh salad a day, and I still had plenty to go.
I always tell some of the people that I work with, and now clients in my practice, I always tell them, like, even if you can grow enough food to supplement, like herbs for your salad or whatever you can grow, because that's medicine, because you've touched it and you have a relationship with it. Like, the intention is there.
Yeah. Yes.
And then, and I think that having a relationship with your food is probably, for me, like the most important aspect of being involved with my food and growing food. What are your thoughts?
Well, the thought that was coming to mind is I've had that experience from childhood because we always had a vegetable garden. When I was a youngster, I wasn't maybe as keen on it as I am now, but because it was one of my chores to, you know, go do things in the garden, and there were other interests at times that conflicted with the chore of working in the garden. But I've always had an opportunity. I've had the space and have had the interest and the time and maybe a little bit of experience to go ahead and grow some of it myself. So I've done that and have that experience, and I certainly encourage that and agree with what you said. What we here in Reno, and I had a very small part, so I should say what my friends really did back a few years ago is start an effort to get to know the local farmers, and our Great Basin Food Co-op has done quite well. Started off 6 years ago roughly with 25 or so members, and I don't know what the membership level is up to now, but we moved into a new facility near the Truckee River in downtown Reno, and have gone from a small shared space to a little bigger space to now this two-story facility that is quite an expansion of the products that can be carried, and the number of people who are growing food has expanded over that time too. So there was an effort to get to know your farmer, and the Slow Food Reno chapter have monthly get-togethers, and you know the local farmers are always identified and encouraged to keep going. So yeah, know your food, get to know a farmer, learn how the food that is purchased in the grocery store, how it gets there, become more aware of that, of sources and such. And I think it's an important thing to do. It's an important thing to do because I believe, and I'm not the only one who believes this, but I believe our food is just way too tied into the dependence on fossil fuel. And so every time we have a blip in the rise in fuel prices, we see not a corresponding rise in food prices, but we see kind of an exponential or a multiplied effect from it because of how the cost of fertilizers, pesticides is increased, how the transportation costs are increased, how the cost of the packaging is increased whenever fossil fuel prices go up. So there are a large number of us who believe that fossil fuels are the Achilles heel of our food. So the more we can do ourselves, it's fun, it's healthy, it tastes great, and it peels away just a little more of our dependence on fossil fuels.
Yeah, it's true. So you've been kind of involved in the Reno area and working on the buy local and also creating jobs along that line in the Reno area. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, and this goes back to the experience I've described earlier in Cleveland at the market. You know, I saw what benefit there was to be. Oh no. Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, hi. Hi, I at the market I saw how the local farmers would benefit from being able to bring their produce into the market, and how much fun our community had in shopping there. So I've always been kind of a believer in the buy local. Again, I wouldn't have necessarily called it that back 20 or 30 years ago, but about 10 years ago, I became aware of the worldwide efforts with localization of let's grow more food locally, let's produce our energy more locally, let's create jobs by having this local economy. And there are a number of reports that say a dollar spent in a local economy, talking about my shopping in for example, the food co-op. The money from the food co-op goes to pay the employees that are from our local urban area for the most part, and then the money goes to pay the local farmers who bring in the produce. The local farmers usually end up sourcing what they need locally as best they can. And so a dollar spent in that type of environment stays in the local economy for a while longer than, say, if I were to purchase a book from, I won't say Amazon because Amazon's a local employer, but if I were to buy a product on the Internet and that company is located in New York City and I pay by credit card, that money goes into their account and it doesn't even touch our local economy here. So I've been an advocate of localization, that effort, localization, relocalization for over 10 years. And I was involved with a not-for-profit back 3 or 4 years ago to create a community center, business incubator, help local business people, and provide training and education, provide some skilling efforts, and essentially create work. And that effort, for a number of reasons, didn't go very far, but Dave Asher is the one who kind of picked up from previous efforts with the Live Local, Buy Local, Create Jobs efforts. And he's done a great job. He's gotten a whole lot of traction, a whole lot of visibility. So it seems like it's the right time.
Yeah, no, I think that a lot of us that have been doing a lot of hard work, it's like, seems like the sun's starting to kind of come out a little bit. We're making progress.
Well, there's motivation. It's, I think with everything from the Internet to, there just seems to have been an expansion of awareness of these kinds of things and the effects of, you know, with the downturn in the economy, people are looking at things more closely. With the availability of money and capital, people are looking at ways to more wisely invest their money. And when I say invest, I also talk about a purchase, because when we take our money out of our wallet and we go buy something, our choice is, do we invest in a local business by making our purchase there, or do we invest our money in another type of business, another type of microeconomy, if you will.
Yes, I'm with you there 100%. Buy local as it possible for your community, definitely.
Yeah, and if I can, Bridget, I want to add to that, because I'm not against the other stores, which I won't name necessarily, because they provide jobs for our neighbors and for our community. But what I suggest is, and what our suggestion is look first locally, then go ahead, and if you can't find it there, or it doesn't make sense to purchase there, to go ahead and go to a local franchise. And then if the local franchise can't provide it, then, you know, just go to a local business.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good plan, because it's not an all or nothing plan. And I think some people get kind of radical about, you know, what normal people hear. So it's nice to hear a message where, you know, it's like, get what you want, but try to find it local first.
Right. Yeah. So, and when I realized that, when I just went through that, when I started with the local business, what I meant to say was locally owned. You know, let's search locally owned first, then a locally owned franchise, then the locally situated businesses, and lastly and not leastly, you know, if we have to, as a last resort, then of course the Internet is available to us.
So at this part of the show, we have about somewhere in there, I always like to try to ask my guests, because I try to do the best possible job to cover all their bases, because I want people to know about your life and why you're doing, you know, the work that you do. Is there anything like that you really want to talk about, or that you are working on, or anything that's really exciting going on in your life, or even advice to people? You know, like, you know, I always love to, you know, whenever I'm working on something new and I feel really passionate about it, it always makes me feel good to talk to people about it, because a lot of people don't have a lot of exposure to certain things unless you go to decide to travel and take jobs, risky jobs sometimes, you know. And you go there, you don't really sometimes see everything that's going on in the world. And a lot of people don't really get that that kind of experience. And I know in my life, I've been lucky enough to kind of fly by the seat of my pants and just be able to try different things and have exposure to different ideas and thoughts and philosophies. And some places I've been have amazing things going on. And then some places I go, I see, you know, environmental just disasters. So is there anything like really exciting or passionate, or anything that's, you know, flipping your switch on at this point?
Well, there are several, and I'll be aware of the fact that we don't have hours to talk about this, so I'll keep it brief. The activity that has really gotten some acceleration here within the last few weeks is our group effort. There are a small group of us that are really looking at coming up with a model for a commercial aquaponics farm business, and we'd like to get the first one going here in Reno. And this is to complement one of my friends, Mark Hebert, has an aquaponics effort going on in kind of south central Reno, out near Meadowood Mall, in that vicinity, where Mark has taken a school bus and he's creating it. He's turning it into a small aquaponics venture, and there he has roughly 120 tomato plants and eggplants growing in it now. Hasn't quite gotten the fish involved yet, but he's picked up some small fry fish, and he's growing them into it, and he hopes to be on aquaponics water or fish water in his system, switching from hydroponics, where he currently is, to aquaponics with the fish by the end of this year. And Mark's been incorporating sensible renewable energy into his what he's calling Bus Aqua, BUSSAQUA. And Mark's doing his little farm, and I'm working with a group, including Mark, to come up with a model for a commercial-sized aquaponics farm here in Reno. So that's one of my exciting projects. And we've gotten a little bit of encouragement through a group that I'd like to mention as well. It's called the Clean Tech Open. And recently, Clean Tech Open has chartered a chapter here in Nevada. And we're what Clean Tech Open is a business plan competition that enables the participants to have exposure to mentors and potential financing. Started off in California in 2006. It has spread across the United States. Nevada has recently joined in. There are a number of, I believe, up to 20 countries overseas that are participating now in the Clean Tech Open, and the notion is what clean technologies need to kind of bubble up through the process, get support, and be successfully implemented. So Clean Tech Open is one of those exciting activities going on at this point. And lastly and not leastly, we seem to be getting some momentum with a fast-growing tree that I'm involved with, several plantations co-located with dairies in California, and eventually hope to have some projects going here in Nevada where the trees are planted and the dairy farmers can put their manure water onto the plantations so that Norwater or the Missouri is not going to a landfill or polluting a waterway, but is actually providing nutrients to the trees in a process called phytoremediation, where we're using, again, biological systems to handle what most people would call waste.
Wow, that's amazing stuff that's going to. Hey, don't forget to put me on your list. If you need a volunteer, laborer, shoveler, you know, I'm pretty good at that.
Yeah, good.
Just as long as I have, like, a pass, you know, to, like, see what's going on, I'll work to death.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad you kind of said that, because one of the other efforts that can always use some volunteers here in the Reno area is our Urban Roots Urban Farm on 4th Street. I just happened to be there this morning. I donated a structure that's being turned into a classroom, and there were 30 or 40 volunteers out there this morning helping with moving the little urban farm demonstration forward, which is set up to introduce school children and parents into growing food in an urban environment, and hopefully end up putting more greenhouses, hoop houses, gardens into our schools. So look up Urban Roots if you have some spare time and want to
I've looked up some of their stuff. And one of the things that I would really like to try to do in Reno while I'm still here is somehow kind of bridge some of the biodynamic stuff with some of the other stuff that other people are doing. And so that we can all kind of, like, work like a community, you know, and be able to educate each other without a lot of stress or competition, you know, on different ways to do things. And right now I'm starting the Waldorf School here in Reno. We have an inspired one, and we're going to be building a garden there that's going to be as much biodynamic as we can. But I've asked some of the permaculture people to come look at it, and you can, if you want, and help us create a design for, you know, better water and also, you know, plant placement and stuff like that. But we'd use, like, biodynamic seeds and all the organic biodynamic sprays, you know, stuff like that.
Right. So, yes. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about that, and just really excited about everyone, and just some of the most amazing stuff is just really starting to bubble to the surface, isn't it? Just really amazing stuff. So I just have a couple more minutes. Is there anything else that is really floating your boat at this time? floating your salad bar.
with regard to urban. Oh, I'm smiling here because of just the shift that has happened, not only in our community, but seemingly around our country and around the world to do things better, to do things in a more healthful manner, to do things in a more considerate manner as far as effects on our communities and effects on our planet. And so in this period where it looks like we have so many things that are broken, this is one of the areas where we have a great deal of opportunity, and more people are becoming engaged, and more people are bringing their creativity into the conversations, into, like, the garden design that you were looking to get for, that you are looking to get for the Waldorf School, that it is truly an amazing, exciting time. You know, there are times when I've been disappointed because I've realized the potential of a lot of these things back in the 70s, and here it is a long time later, and have been frustrated by, you know, what's it going to take to bring our attention to these things, and it looks like it's happening. Regardless of what the motivations are, it looks like it was happening when I was an outreach person for the greenhouses over in the hoop houses at UNR, and I did a last Saturday of the month open house where I did tours of the greenhouses and the hoop houses, and I also did an introduction to hydroponics, and always in all the sessions that I did, a third of the attendees stayed behind and said, "John, show me how to do this at home." And so, you know, I'm glad. I'm glad of the interest. I'm glad of the opportunity to be here with you.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited, and I'm so glad that you made it on the show. And like you in the past, I've had periods where I thought, wow, you know, we're not going to make it. Our civilization is going to crack off, and there's only so much I can do, right, to like hold it together.
I am surprised that we've made it this far. That's for sure. I mean,
yeah,
having grown up where we were simulating nuclear attacks back in grade school, you know, so it's,
yeah.
I'm glad. I'm glad of it. I'm glad for it. I'm glad we have all the listeners out there listening to us.
Yeah, and I'm glad that I always thank the universe every day that I'm healthy. But then, you know, I think about too is there was the, and I can't remember what his name was, but he was a Zen Buddhist guy, and they asked him one time like what his take on Hitler was. This was like, I don't know, in the 70s or something. Like what he thought the long term implications would be. And his response was like, "We don't know. We have to wait for like 200 years to be able to see what the outcome is going to be." And so I think I have to remind myself every day, like, whatever I'm doing now, maybe 50 years down the road, or maybe like after I'm not here, my contribution maybe will do something. And we'll see the outcome then when we need it, like maybe even the most.
And what's coming to mind is the whole concept of the seven generations, you know, that certainly I've tried my best to leave the place better for the seventh generation.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. So our show's getting ready to end, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on the show, and I can't wait to sit and have coffee with you sometime or dig a hole and talk more and pick your brain. But for today, I'm going to let you go, and thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome, Bridget. Thank you, and let's keep growing.
We will, we will. Bye, John.
Bye, good day.
All right, well, that's the Urban Farm Project with our host, our guest, John Toth, and that's it. And keep growing food and grow food in your yard and eat your food that you grow, and that's it. And Bridget Dolgoff saying goodbye. Thanks so much.